La corresponsal de Noticias RT, Ángela Gallardo, reporta desde Madrid.
Miles de personas se han concentrado por segundo día consecutivo en los alrededores del Congreso de los Diputados, que permanece blindado por la policía. De momento no se ha registrado ningún incidente y la jornada se ha desarrollado de forma completamente pacífica. Una imagen muy distinta a la que veíamos ayer: duras cargas policiales, enfrentamientos que se han saldado con 35 personas detenidas y 64 heridos. La convocatoria de hoy, la concentración de este miércoles, era para protestar por las actuaciones policiales del martes, pero además también para volver a mostrar ese descontento con la clase política, la oposición, con las medidas del gobierno. Recordamos que la acción rodea el Congreso, quiere reclamar de manera simbólica un proceso constituyente porque, dicen, los políticos tienen secuestrada la democracia. Una acción que no termina hoy. Han hecho un nuevo llamamiento para volver a rodear el Congreso el próximo sábado. Si durante todo el día se han sucedido las reacciones a las cargas policiales que los manifestantes han calificado de indiscriminadas. Sin embargo, desde el gobierno las han justificado por las agresiones que dicen sufrieron algunos agentes por parte de determinados manifestantes. Desde la oposición han criticado la postura del gobierno, han pedido la dimisión de la delegada en Madrid, Cristina Cifuentes, y han exigido una investigación para poder determinar si había policía infiltrada entre los manifestantes que provocaron a los antidisturbios para que iniciara esas cargas. El presidente del gobierno, Mariano Rajoy, no ha hecho referencia a estos incidentes, pero sí ha querido recordar que hay una parte de la ciudadanía que está de acuerdo con su gestión.
El pueblo griego realizó un nuevo paro nacional de 24 horas contra los recortes sociales impuestos por el gobierno. Rafael Cuesta reporta.
Trabajadores y trabajadoras de Grecia comenzaron en la medianoche del 26 de septiembre un nuevo paro de 24 horas contra el duro paquete de recortes propuesto por el gobierno de Antonis Samaras y que afectará fundamentalmente a empleados y pensionistas. Los principales sindicatos del país convocaron a esta jornada de huelga general, que es un grito de indignación y de desesperación por lo que está pasando, según Yanis Panagopoulos, presidente de la Confederación General de Trabajadores de Grecia, GSE. Además de GSE, sindicato mayoritario en el sector privado, también se adhirieron a la convocatoria la Confederación de Empleados Públicos, ADEDI, el Frente Militante de Todos los Trabajadores, PAME, de orientación comunista, y la Confederación General de Profesores, Artesanos y Comerciantes. En el sector público el paro es total, tanto en los ministerios como en las administraciones regionales y locales, así como en las empresas estatales, transportes, aduanas, colegios, universidades y hospitales. Los organizadores advierten que esta huelga es una de las de mayor impacto de los últimos meses en el sector privado, debido a que a la misma se sumaron los controladores aéreos, los trabajadores de la marina mercante, los empleados del sector de la banca y los autónomos integrantes de la Confederación General de Profesionales, Artesanos y Comerciantes.
En Puerto Rico, un jurado federal delibera en torno a la sentencia de pena de muerte en el caso de Edison Burgos Montes, un empresario convicto por el asesinato y desaparición de Marilyn Semiday Morales, un informante de la Policía Antinarcóticos Norteamericana, la DEA. Según la Fiscalía, el acusado dio muerte y luego desapareció a su compañera consensual por temor a que ésta revelara a las autoridades sus actividades delictivas. El jurado, que el pasado agosto encontrara a Burgos Montes culpable de homicidio, ahora deberá considerar si el acusado asesinó a Semiday Morales intencionalmente, infligió serio daño corporal que resultó en su muerte, consideró y contempló quitarle la vida y demostró un desprecio temerario por la vida humana. Carmelo Campos es defensor de derechos humanos e integrante de la coalición contra la pena de muerte.
El jurado determinó de forma unánime su culpabilidad a base de evidencia circunstancial, no de evidencia directa de encontrar el cuerpo y de saber que él fue el asesino, un testimonio de que yo la maté o algo por el estilo. Y ahora nos encontramos con la etapa más crítica, que es la etapa de la sentencia, donde el jurado está deliberando y está determinando cuál es la pena que usarla.
Campos añade que el juicio de Burgos y la convicción de este están operando en esencia en evidencia circunstancial, en un intento de encontrar culpabilidad en el acusado.
Las circunstancias curiosas en ese caso es que el cadáver de la víctima nunca ha aparecido y ahora mismo el jurado se encuentra en la etapa de deliberar si le van a dar una pena de muerte o le van a dar cadena perpetua.
Se alerta al hecho de que se está hablando de la justicia norteamericana, la misma que envía a gente inocente a prisión o a la inyección letal, es decir, a la pena capital.
Que en Estados Unidos se han dado casos donde personas que han sido acusadas, incluso ejecutadas por asesinato de personas, de cadáveres que no han aparecido, y después de haber sido ejecutadas, las personas supuestamente asesinadas han aparecido vivas.
Hay que tomar en cuenta que Estados Unidos continúa negando que Puerto Rico sea una colonia e insiste en que se trata de un Estado libre asociado. Sin embargo, ese Estado no tiene la libertad para avanzar su propia política exterior sin el permiso del Congreso norteamericano, y Washington ahora trata de imponer la pena capital sin importar la inconstitucionalidad de esta en la isla.
Se quiere utilizar la jurisdicción federal para imponer la pena de muerte en algo que es totalmente ajeno a la idiosincrasia del pueblo puertorriqueño y que resulta realmente escandaloso y totalmente a los principios más básicos de autodeterminación de un pueblo.
Al finalizar la guerra entre Estados Unidos y España, Washington se anexó las colonias de Madrid, entre ellas las Filipinas y Puerto Rico. Después, el Congreso norteamericano revisó la constitución puertorriqueña y dejó intacta la cláusula sobre la pena capital. De nuevo, Carmelo Campos, de la Coalición contra la Pena de Muerte en Puerto Rico.
La constitución del denominado Estado Libre Asociado de Puerto Rico ha sido aprobada por la Asamblea Constituyente, fue el Congreso de los Estados Unidos. Y el Congreso de los Estados Unidos tuvo la oportunidad de aquellas cosas que entendía que no debían estar, eliminarlas, y eliminó algunos derechos de naturaleza económica, derechos sociales, derechos culturales. Pero la prohibición contra la pena de muerte la dejó intacta.
Campos señala que no obstante el precedente legal en la isla, el gobierno norteamericano insiste en cambiar las reglas del juego.
Lo que resulta paradójico, impresionante, es que el comportamiento del gobierno da totalmente al traste con los planteamientos que se habían hecho anteriormente, que dice una cosa, pero realmente lo que está haciendo es todo lo contrario.
Campos dice que el fallo contra Burgos pudiera sentar las bases para aplicar la pena capital a más de una docena de casos.
El jurado está en el proceso de liberación, pero además de eso tenemos otros 17 casos donde el gobierno federal está buscando y podrían finalizar con una ejecución de las personas.
No obstante, el Estado Libre Asociado de Puerto Rico, un fallo de culpabilidad contra Burgos podría traducirse en una ejecución fuera de la isla caribeña.
Si se da un veredicto de pena de muerte, lo que sucedería es que esta persona iría a la cadena de la muerte federal, que está en el estado de Indiana, donde están todas las personas que la jurisdicción federal están esperando su ejecución. Esperemos que eso no pase, por supuesto.
Campos dice que si bien el gobierno estadounidense acordó respetar las leyes puertorriqueñas y la idiosincrasia boricua, tiene largo tiempo queriendo imponer la pena capital en la isla.
Puerto Rico abolió la pena de muerte en 1929. La última ejecución se realizó en 1927. La constitución que se aprobó en 1952 expresamente prohíbe la pena de muerte. Y a partir del 1994, el gobierno federal ha buscado imponerla a través de su legislación federal para aquellos delitos que tienen bajo su jurisdicción.
Campos concluye diciendo que queda más que claro que Washington se está desenmascarando y ahora abiertamente busca imponer sus leyes a la isla como si se tratara de su propiedad o su colonia.
Si hubiese el más mínimo grado de desrespeto a lo que es la voluntad del pueblo puertorriqueño, el gobierno federal de los Estados Unidos no estuviese actuando en contra de la voluntad de este pueblo. Entonces, el llamado Estado Libre Asociado, que no es ni libre, es asociado, que más bien es una forma bonita y llamativa de llamar lo que es un estado colonial o lo que se diría en derecho internacional un territorio no autónomo. Lo que tenemos en la realidad es que el pueblo de Puerto Rico está completamente supeditado a las leyes que aprobó el Congreso de Estados Unidos sin tener ningún poder de intervenir en ellas.
Puerto Rico prohibió primero la pena de muerte en 1929 a través de una legislación y de nuevo al aprobar la Constitución de 1952, pues considera la pena capital como una violación a los derechos humanos. En Los Ángeles, yo soy Fernando Velázquez.
Hemos llegado al final de otra edición del Informativo Pacífica. A nombre del director del proyecto, Fernando Velázquez, se despide Norma Martínez.
You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, freakradio.org. Fight the system.
Tune in at 7 p.m. for The Great Leap Forward. This is really good.
interview. You really, this guy, he is.
Cut! Take two!
Tune in on The Great Leap Forward. On, oh yeah, we have a radio station. On Free Radio Santa Cruz. What's the matter with me? I'm losing something. What is it? Oh yeah, my mind. On The Great Leap Forward at 7 p.m. on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101 FM. It's so complicated, this whole thing. I don't know if I can take it much longer. There's nothing better on Free Radio than The Great Leap Forward. You're going to want to gather around the radio at 7 p.m. Wednesday. Every Wednesday. If you miss one, you could perish. Yes, your life could become nothing at all. Bob's making me do this. If anyone can hear this, please come help me. He's keeping me captive. Where are the refreshments anyway? I thought there'd be chocolate-covered strawberries.
After you're done, you get your treat. Get to work. I can't work like this!
Foolery, or should I say Malkin foolery. We're going to have a little Norse foolery coming up. You're tuned to Free Radio 101.3 FM, and we're streaming as well, as you might know. So stay tuned for 2 hours of this and that. Hopefully a call-in from Occupy San Francisco was busted last night. Also some flashbacks, some recent interview clips and blips, and a follow-up on an open mic session that was held at the Sub Rosa a couple weeks ago around the Santa Cruz 11. Some of the more choice morsels. In fact, we have an open mic coming up tonight at the Sub Rosa. For those of you who want to belly up to the Rosa at 7:30, sign up and do some speaking, singing, or performing. That's at 7:03 Pacific. Anyway, stay tuned. You don't have to do anything if you just listen to this show, but you can call in. The call-in numbers are 427-3772, 427-3772. And I'll be here.
Oh, the candidates of Dodger, yes, a well-known Dodger. Oh, the candidates of Dodger, yes, and I'm a Dodger too. He'll meet you and treat you and ask you for your vote. But look out, boys, he's dodging for your note.
Oh, we're all dodging, 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 dodging. Oh, we're all dodging all the way through the world.
Oh, the merchant is a Dodger, yes, a well-known Dodger. Oh, the merchant is a Dodger, yes, and I'm a Dodger, too. He'll sell you the goods at double the price. When you go to pay him, you'll have to pay him twice.
Oh, we're all Dodgers, 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 Dodgers. Oh, we're all Dodgers all the way through the world.
Oh, the lawyer is a Dodger, yes, a well-known Dodger. Oh, the lawyer is a Dodger, yes, and I'm a Dodger, too. He'll plead your case like a mighty fine friend, but look out, boys, he's easy for to bend.
Oh, we're all dodging, 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 dodging. Oh, we're all dodging all the way through the world.
Oh, the general is a dodger, yes, a well-known dodger. Oh, the general is a dodger, yes, and I'm a dodger too. He'll march you up and he'll march you down, but look out, boys, he'll put you underground.
Oh, we're all dodging, 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 dodging. Oh, we're all dodging all the way through the world.
Oh, the preacher is a Dodger, yes, a well-known Dodger. Oh, the preacher is a Dodger, yes, and I'm a Dodger, too. He'll preach you the gospel, tell you of your crimes, but look out, boys, he's a Dodger for your dime.
Oh, we're all Dodgers, 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 hallelujah, I'm a Dodger all the way through the world.
Oh, the doctor is a Dodger, yes, a well-known Dodger. Oh, the doctor is a Dodger, yes, and I'm a Dodger, too.
come to you and cure you and act like a friend. But when you get the bill, you'll be sick again.
Oh, we're all dodging, 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 dodging. Oh, we're all dodging on the way through the world.
Oh, the lover is a dodger, yes, a well-known dodger. Oh, the lover is a dodger, yes, and I'm a dodger too. Freddy, I can hear those church bells chime.
I can hear them too, so I'm dodging down the line.
Oh, we're all dodging, 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 dodging. Oh, we're all dodging on the way through the world.
Oh, the singer is a dodger, yes, a well-known dodger. Oh, the singer is a dodger, yes, and I'm a dodger too.
Sitting on the porch all day long, and he just keeps singing this same damn song.
Oh, we're all dodging, 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 dodging. Oh, we're all dodging down the way through the world. Oh, we're all dodging, 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 dodging. Oh, we're all dodging down the way through the world.
Tell me I was building a dream, and so I followed the mob. When there was earth to plow or guns to bear, I was always there, right there on the job. They used to tell me I was building a dream with peace and glory ahead. Why should I be standing in line, just waiting for bread? Once I built a railroad, made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower to the sun, made of brick and rivet and lime. Once I built a tower, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once in khaki suits, gee, we looked swell, full of that Yankee doodly-dum. Half a million boots went slogging through hell, and I was the guy with the drum. Say, don't you remember, they called me Al. It was Al all the time. Say, don't you remember? I'm your pal. Buddy, can you spare a dime?
And that was two from the Weavers, We're All Dodging, and Brother, Can You Spare a Dime, an old favorite. We'll be hearing more from the Weavers as this show goes on. Welcome to Bathrop Spears Broadsides, the September 27th edition. And what have we got for you today? Well, we've got a hope that there'll be a call-in from Occupy San Francisco, which apparently was deoccupied last night. What I'm going to do is I'm going to read from the Occupy San Francisco website, which is not a particularly happy story, but and again. Around 11 p.m. on September 26th, that's last night, ADSFPD, San Francisco Police Department, guys, I don't want to call them goons, that wouldn't be fair, although perhaps it might be accurate, clad in riot gear, snuck up on Occupy San Francisco's Federal Reserve demonstration site and reportedly arrested 40 occupiers allegedly for, quote, illegal camping, which is to say really illegal lodging, because that's PC 647E that apparently That's what they were arrested for. The same thing that Linda LeMaster goes to trial for in 2 weeks for a similar protest way back in 2010, in August, the Peace Camp 2010. The officers reportedly gave no notice to disperse and stealthily flanked and surrounded the demonstration from Main Street and Stewart Street. Accompanying the San Francisco PD were 11 DPW, Department of Public Works, trucks, who seized the protesters' property, which was taken to 2323 Cesar Chavez Street, a long way from downtown San Francisco. A couple of points about that. 647E is also the code section used to ticket and harass multiple protesters in Occupy Santa Cruz. It's also in the past been used against homeless people more sparingly, but particularly when they come together in protests, then they are subject to this so-called lodging law, indicating that even though you thought it was public property and you thought you had a right to be there in order to demonstrate or protest or just simply assert First Amendment rights, carry a sign, wait for the mayor to come out of his office so you could approach him to try to talk to him, let your opinion be known, you don't have that right if the authorities decide that they don't want you there. At least that's the message of the 647E, though it's only in Santa Cruz that I've heard 647E cases actually being won in courts, which is kind of interesting. There were four cases last year. Actually, I think it was the year before last. No, it was last year. It was in 2011. Five or six folks from the Peace Camp 2010 out of 40 or 50 who got 647E citations, again, for being on the steps of the courthouse at night with signs about the sleeping ban, a law that criminalizes homeless people at night in the city of Santa Cruz, and also similar ordinances do it in the county of Santa Cruz. And they were dragged into court. And I believe Ed Fry, Gary Johnson, and at least three others were convicted in a very rare series of jury trials where the folks, they didn't have public defenders. They had Ed Fry defending them, which I think was a mistake, not because Ed is necessarily incompetent per se, but he's not really versed in the kind of the ways and wherefores of the Santa Cruz courts around statutory law, the law that's on the books, as distinguished from the basic constitutional law, which is a law that really is a more simple, basic law that we think should apply to all of us, the right to freedom of speech, freedom of the press, to associate freely, freedom of religion and freedom from religion, the right to due process, the right to be free from search and seizure, cruel and unusual punishment. These are kind of more simple things that are in the first 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution and in numerous of the amendments to the California, I think, provisions of the California Constitution, too, California State Constitution. But you also have to know the actual ups and downs of the specific codes, the various precedents that have been set in different places around this 647E statute. And that's what would make Linda's LeMaster's trial so interesting. She has a very, I would say, studious and diligent attorney who is particularly interested in those aspects of the law. He has, his name is Jonathan Gettleman. I've talked about him on the show. I've even, I think, interviewed him on the show in the past. And he has challenged Linda's case on the grounds of the First Amendment, but very specifically and very in great detail with a writ of habeas corpus, which normally means just bring me into court and show me the charges. But in this case meant, in Linda's case, it meant this law cannot be used as it's being used to even take an individual into court, because it really is a basic violation of the First Amendment, which is the right of a person to hold up a sign at night, as Linda was doing, or a sign was sitting next to her. That's what she was there for. And there was no curfew at that time, although the fact that there is a curfew now should, of course, be struck down as well as unconstitutional. So Linda, I think, has an interesting case coming up. The case of the people who were convicted in Santa Cruz. And I'm saying Santa Cruz is one of the only cities where there was a conviction of 647E that I've heard about. Mostly people get charged with it, and they kind of dicker, they plea bargain, they essentially leave the area because that's what the authorities want them to do. They want them to abandon their protest. It's mainly kind of a protest-busting ordinance. And then they just sort of let it go. unless, of course, they think that people are going to come back. And the Occupy protests in Santa Cruz, it was a little different. The Occupy people were multiply charged with 647E. That's many of them were charged, I should say. A few may have gotten more than one citation. But none of them were ever taken to court on this charge. They've all sort of disappeared. Although these charges can reappear in the strangest times. So, for instance, Isaac Collins, or the Lyrical Eye, whose poetry I've played on this show before, who was part of the information services for Occupy Santa Cruz, African-American activist and poet, was arrested, the only person arrested, up at the Great Meadow up in UCSC land. On April 20th, he was arrested and charged with, I don't know, sales of marijuana. Everybody was running around smoking and sharing and presumably also selling. And he was the only person who got busted. And this seemed pretty horrendous to me and pretty selective. And that anybody is getting busted for marijuana use, unless, for example, I don't know, you're driving and smoking and driving in an erratic way. That might make some sense, but not celebrating something in the sunshine on a day with 1,000 other people out there. Anyway, he was busted. He was taken to jail. He was held for a number of days. I believe it was a number of days. And he was released, and the charges disappeared. But I was told by him in a phone conversation, or at least a phone message, a couple of days ago, that he's back in court under those charges. And I don't know whether it's a felony sales or a misdemeanor sales. In fact, I may be wrong about it even being that charge, but I think that it has to do with that, and it shows that there's this incredible leeway that prosecutors have and police departments have to forward information months and months later about a so-called crime and then drag you into court. That happened, of course, with the Santa Cruz 11. Those of us who are charged with supporting or reporting on or being present in the building of the Wells Fargo empty bank building, 3.5 years empty, that was occupied back in December of last year by the Occupy folks to encourage the community to set up a community center, to encourage people to be aware of Wells Fargo's crimes, to dramatize the homeless situation. It was a First Amendment protest. And instead of going out, you didn't even think they go after the organizers of the protest. They didn't. Instead, they went after some of the people who just went in there to report and support and show some solidarity with the people there, at least the objectives of the people there. Not that anybody who went in planned it or was a part of that organization activity that I know of. But, you know, they're charged with two felonies and two misdemeanors each. They're still going to court. There's a court date coming up on October 9th, next Tuesday, at 8:15 in the morning, where there's a motion to dismiss in the case of Cameron Lorando. Cameron's an activist who hasn't been around Santa Cruz much. I've only met him a couple times in court. I may have met him at the Occupy movement when it was at its height. I was running around doing a lot of recording of interviews and so forth. It's kind of blurry. That was last year in September, October, and November, a little bit into December. But anyway, that's happening in court. His attorney, Alexis Briggs, will be in court on October 9th doing some... presumably trying to have his case dismissed. And that should also be the case for Franklin Alcantara, also known as Angel. But for some reason, I'm told his attorney, Jesse Rubin, is declining to do that. And we've also asked Jesse Rubin to share his discovery with us. That is to say, the information that District Attorney Rebecca Young has provided in this case, this Santa Cruz 11 case, which has been very... very strange. Most of it has been coming out in drips and drabs. She's been constantly reassuring the court and the defendants. She's given them all the videotapes and all that kind of stuff, but it hasn't been provided. And my attorney is going to go to court and try to demand, as the judge said we should have, a list of all the evidence that supposedly was given to us so that we can see that we actually have what we need to defend ourselves. Ironically, it may turn out we don't need any of that stuff because their case is so weak. But the problem is it's all sort of shrouded in this sort of shadowy threat of 7 years in prison because that's the maximum sentence for two felonies and two misdemeanors of this sort. We're accused of conspiracy, conspiracy to trespass, conspiracy to vandalize, felony vandalism. There's no direct evidence of any of that kind of stuff. We didn't do that stuff. I was there as a reporter, as were, and others were there as supporters. But they are picking people out who are simply visible and known to them. Anyway, this might be easier if you've been charged with 647E, which is what the San Francisco occupation folks were charged with, apparently. Again, I find myself doubtful as to whether these cases will ever go to court. I was charged with the predecessor to 647E. I think it was called 647J or 647I. It's the same so-called lodging law, which was used to run off protesters way back in 1990 when we did a large protest in front of the San Francisco City Hall opposing then-Mayor Agnos's anti-homeless policies. And we were all arrested, taken to jail, booked, and then all the charges were later dropped. And that's, I think, I don't know, in this case, it's hard to say. I'm not really familiar with what they've been doing with the San Francisco occupiers. It may depend on whether they come back or not. Anyway, last night, around 11, 40 of them, according to this report, which is on the Occupy San Francisco website, were arrested and taken to jail. The other issue that I wanted to bring up was that their property was seized in 11, count them, 11, if this report is accurate, public works trucks, and taken to 2323 Cesar Chavez Street, a long way from downtown San Francisco. And it's interesting that it wasn't taken to the city dump, and probably the reason it wasn't was because of the Levon decision, which came out a couple weeks ago in a Los Angeles case, which ruled that you can't do what the Santa Cruz authorities did on December 8th to the homeless campsite and the property there, and has been doing all summer in the sweeps, and what the Parks and Rec and the labor-ready crews and so forth have been doing regularly for years, which is destroy homeless property, claiming you don't have to save it if it's, quote, abandoned. That is, it's okay to just come in one day, post a notice that says, we're coming to take your property, and then just come and take it and destroy it. Within a day, a couple of days, with the assumption that, oh, it's abandoned if nobody's picked it up. That violates California law. It also violates the Constitution. And I always found it hard to understand how John Wallace, who was the head of Parks and Rec, could do that, probably because, as Steve Clark, our deputy police chief or vice police chief, said when he was asked, why are you taking blankets from those homeless people when photos of the blankets will do just as well if you want to show they're violating the blanket ban? Because I can, is what he said. And that's often why authorities do act. They act inappropriately, and that's why we can't empower them in these ways, because they do act in ways, because they have the power to act that way. That's the real danger of all the police expansion laws, the power laws that expand the local police powers, expand the national police powers, the National Defense Authorization Act that was recently very courageously blocked by a judge, and that unfortunately that blockage was set aside by a higher court, and it's now being appealed and is probably going to not be blocked, and we're going to be faced with a situation where the judges are in essence saying that there is no constitution except what the Fuhrer in charge says there is. That is to say, in this case, it's, you know, the Democratic hero, the lesser evil, Obama, who I hear, well, too much about. Several citizens, this article continues in the San Francisco Occupy story, appeared on the scene and attempted to ascertain the identity of the officers involved and the law of which they were enforcing. However, they were threatened with arrest without a response to their inquiries. Fence around the Occupy San Francisco demo site. After the protesters were arrested and their property seized, a fence was erected around the demonstration site, allegedly for construction to keep the protesters from returning to protest the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco, who enables the current economic corruption through fraud and crony capitalism. In December of 2011, Mayor Ed Lee, that's the mayor of San Francisco, ordered the removal of the demonstration and similarly the property of protesters and subsequently set up barricades around Occupy San Francisco's General Assembly area. And then I guess these folks moved to the Federal Reserve area. A little unclear about, I think there was another plaza, either at the Civic Center or Justin Herman Plaza, and then they've continued this occupation here for pretty continuously since last year until last night. The Department of Public Works property seizures are an interesting matter. Property is routinely not found at 2023 Cesar Chavez, and that which is returned is often broken due to mishandling. According to a DPW worker, one truck brings in the loads and another, who was not present at the time of seizure, unloads the truck. Not knowing what part of the truck belongs to who creates a guessing game for the employees without any itemized list of property connected to a name. If that's the case, of course, it's violating the state law, the Constitution, and the federal court decision, the Lavon decision. If any attorneys are willing to step forward or any individuals want to make claims in small claims court without attorneys. Some property will have a date and maybe the place of seizure, but the system or lack thereof has been the source of thousands of dollars of Occupy San Francisco's property disappearing after being seized by the SFPD and the Department of Public Works. Mayor Ed Lee and Mohammed Nuru's history of nepotism is another interesting story. I'm not sure who Nuru is. In a city with so much wealth and equality, it is a sad fact that the homeless are so routinely demonized and terrorized by the local government and its constituents, the writer continues. No sit-lie, no large vehicles in lower-income neighborhoods, demonization in the media, constant gentrification, the surrealism induces impressions of early Nazi Germany where the poor were blamed for the bad economy and not the bankers. San Francisco can do better. City-sponsored discrimination against economic status is still discrimination and may be actionable under California Civil Codes 51.7, 52.1, Penal Codes 422.7A and B, 422.75 and 422.9, and U.S. Title 42, Sections 1983, 1985, and 1986. I have no idea what most of the sections are. But that's the story from the San Francisco Occupy, or at least from... Yeah, it was on the Occupy San Francisco website. And it looks like we're not necessarily going to be hearing from our friends up north, but perhaps we will, never can tell. I'm also hoping to hear from Steve Schnarr, who's been giving us the update on the bounce around that the city's SCPD seized bikes are going through after, was it Lieutenant Martinez and... I hope we have the right lieutenant here. My apologies if I don't. Hillary Bryant and a certain faction on the city council has apparently shifted the bikes from the bike church. They were being donated to the bike church to be passed on to poor people and be repaired and given out to for essentially charitable purposes, sent then to the Bike Dojo, a for-profit shop that apparently has not even been able to keep up with the bikes, and so they're eventually wending their way back to the bike church through a sort of a circuitous process, which perhaps Steve will explain it if he gets on the air. I think I read his email last show, for those of you who are regular listeners, but he probably can talk about it in more detail. Well, while you're chewing on that cud, here's a little more music from the Weavers, and perhaps your phone calls at 427-3772. 427-FRSC.
They used to tell me I was building a dream.
Lord, Lord, I got them jackhammer blues. Been building your roads and bridges too, and I'm gonna build a dam or two. Lord, 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 I got them jackhammer blues. Hammered on the Bonneville, hammered on the Butte, Columbia River to the 5 mile chute. Lord, Lord, I got them jackhammer blues. Hammered on the Boulder, Cooley too, always broke when the job was through.
Lord, Lord, I got them jackhammer blues.
when I'm chasing them gals again.
Hard money got them jackhammer blues.
I'm a hammering man from a hammering town. I can hammer on a hammer till the sun goes down.
Hard money, I got them jackhammer blues.
Hammering in the rain and a hammering in the dust. Hammering in the best and a hammering in the worst.
Hard money, I got them jackhammer blues.
Got a jackhammer gal, as sweet as fly, gonna hammer on a hammer till the day I die.
Lord, 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 I got them jackhammer blues.
Jackhammer John was a jackhammer man.
And I'm gonna build a dam or two.
Lord, 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 I got them jackhammer blues.
Got a jackhammer gal as sweet as pie, gonna hammer on a hammer till the day I die.
Lord, 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 I got them jackhammer blues.
And that was Jackhammer Blues. Again, the Weavers Strike Back. On the line with us is Steve Schnarr. Do I have that pronunciation right, Steve?
It's Schnarr, actually.
Schnarr rhymes with car, far, and that sort of thing?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks for having me on, Robert.
Say again?
Thanks for having me on.
Oh, yeah, sure. Thanks for coming on. I know you're rushing off to a meeting shortly.
And yeah, I got a little while, but yeah.
I just want to also advise people that this is the time when the desal issue is coming up at Loudoun Nelson before the city council candidate clump of council candidates, most of whom are undistinguishable from each other and equally unappealing, and that's at Loudoun Nelson Center. In case you want to hear how they stand on the issues of this multi-million-dollar desal bondugel that is being pushed by Don Lane and the current city council. We could begin with that. Any comments on that, Steve? I know you're with a number of groups, People Power, Bike Church. No, you're not representing anybody here, but what you're just speaking as an individual. Any thoughts on that issue?
Well, I know I haven't looked into the details as much as some people in town, but the overall concept is seems problematic to me that partly looking into the future with global warming, there might not be as much rainfall, and so the solution is to burn fossil fuels to desalinate ocean water, thereby exacerbating global warming. But I think that's the big problem. I've heard much more subtle analysis of the details of it, which I don't feel qualified to try to comment on. But yeah, it definitely seems like we should just be working hard to use less water in a more serious way than we're often willing to consider.
Steve, how long have you been in Santa Cruz?
Over 10 years.
And your principal focus has been around, what, alternate transportation? That's how I know you, because I hang out at the Sub Rosa every Wednesday with the Huff meetings, which, for all you listeners, come on down, 10 o'clock, free coffee every Wednesday at the Sub Rosa Cafe. But Sub Rosa is kind of right between the Bike Church and People Power. You seem to have been involved in both those groups. Has that been your sort of principal political activity for the last decade?
I've always had a broad vision in my mind of things that I care about and could get involved in. But in fact, before I moved here, I was involved a lot with this so-called anti-globalization movement and protest. But as far as I've been involved with the Bike Church for 10 years, and I've been working with the nonprofit that manages that community center and includes the Bike Church and the youth program of People Power, for maybe 4 years, and then in the last 2 years I've been working for People Power. So I end up putting a lot of time into that type of stuff. But I also started the Santa Cruz Fruit Tree Project, which isn't exactly political, but I think there's the Santa Cruz Fruit Tree Project. We find there's a lot of fruit that falls on the ground and rots, and people aren't using it. So we get together people have fun community events where people can get fruit and do, you know, learn how to process it, make applesauce, dry it, make your own alcohol, whatever you want to do. And we're having a cider pressing event this Sunday, actually, at the Live Oak Grange.
But where is that Live Oak Grange, and what time is it?
It's on 17th Avenue. Uh-huh. It's a resource center for agriculture that dates back into the 1800s, but in the modern incarnation in Santa Cruz is a more of kind of organic agriculture and kind of permaculture stuff.
What time is that going to be on Sunday?
So we're going to meet at 10 at the Grange, and then we're going to go split up from there to pick some apples from an orchard in the hills, and some people go out there into the SoCal Hills. Some people go right around the corner to a yard in Live Oak that has a number of trees in it, and then we have a bunch of hand-powered pressing equipment. So I'm just bringing that up as an example. It's something that I'm doing, and it's trying to have fun events to get people together and connect them with, you know, being outside, growing your own food. And I definitely think I have, you know, this kind of two-prong approach of building up positive things and then challenging, you know, the problems that we face. And so the problem, I think, is industrial agriculture is bad for the earth, bad for animals, bad for people. And I was working a lot, actually, last year on the methyl iodide campaign, which was a pesticide, or is a chemical that had recently been approved to be used as a pesticide, which was extremely toxic, even more than most pesticides are, and it would very much threaten farm workers and people who live near fields. And so that, to me, is like but you're right, I spend a lot of my you know, actual waking hours dealing with bike-related stuff, but I have these other things that I get involved in as well.
So the methyl iodide situation, just very briefly, is it currently any better than it was? I know methyl bromide was a concern of people for a number of years.
These are both gases that they inject into the soil before they plant to kill everything in the soil. So again, which is the opposite of organic agriculture, where you try to build up a healthy combination, you know, ecosystem in the soil. But the methyl bromide floats away. You know, they inject it in the soil and they tarp it over, and we've all seen that. But some of it escapes, you know, it gets really windy and it is toxic. And in fact, the EPA just admitted that from like a lawsuit dating back to 99 that their continuing approval of methyl iodide has posed disproportionate health effects on Latino school children. And that, but the reason they're phasing it out is not because it hurts people's health, it's because if the gas floats away and gets high up into the atmosphere and destroys the ozone layer, and so for an international treaty, the U.S. is required to phase it out, but they keep delaying it. They say we can't get rid of it until there's an alternative.
Are we talking about methyl iodide or methyl bromide?
Methyl bromide.
Right.
So this is the whole thing. We can't get rid of it. We need an alternative, even though it's been banned. And, you know, which I think is just is a backwards way of thinking, that it's our God-given right to grow strawberries in like endless fields that, you know, that go on for miles. You know, it's like, what are people used to grow apples in those fields? Why can't they grow apples if they're easier to grow without poison chemicals? But in any case, the alternative that was proposed was another chemical which is even more toxic to humans, called methyl iodide, but it's also heavier, and so it wouldn't float up and destroy the ozone layer. But it's quite an astonishing one. It's one of these cases. I wonder if people are just pushing that just to take up our time to fight against it. It was so outrageous. It was like there were all these biochemists and chemists from around the country and Nobel Prize winners and, you know, prestigious people who aren't activists necessarily, and they were coming out and saying this is one of the most toxic chemicals on Earth, and we can't believe that you would even consider.
So what's the status of it now? Is it currently being used in
it,
Santa Cruz?
It had got a few approvals, and they had done some small-scale applications, but the big use was supposed to be the strawberry fields, of which our county and Monterey have a lot of the strawberry fields in the state. But due to opposition here and elsewhere, and we got, you know, including the city of Watsonville, the county of Santa Cruz, and the county of Watsonville, the county of Monterey, all of those governing bodies passed resolutions against it, and there was a lot of opposition, and eventually the company that holds the patent pulled it from the market, citing controversy and fears of people picketing the field. And so at least for now, it's not going to be in use. But because the government never actually reviewed it and banned it, theoretically someone could revive it. But at least, you know, for me that felt like pretty awesome victory. I've worked on a lot of things that, you know, it didn't matter how hard people worked or how much happened, and the government just ignores this completely. So it was good to see, at least in this case.
And that was, apparently you've had another victory recently. You know, we've talked about this on the air, and I read your letter and some notes that I took from the phone conversation we had on Sunday. We had a conversation, I think, on Saturday or before. But it was, you apparently been trying to determine just, well, you've had sort of a partial victory. You haven't really been able to uncover the mystery trail as to who made the decision and why to stop giving bikes that were abandoned to the bike church and instead decided to turn them over to the bike dojo. But you did have some, you did get some correspondence from one of the deputy chiefs or one of the...
the assistant city manager who had, I got an answer from the police months ago of why they say they changed the program. It wasn't a very good answer, but that I don't really believe that it was, you know, very convincing.
What was their answer at that time?
Well, they said for cost saving, and because the other group picked up the bikes from them, but they never asked us if we could pick up the bikes. They said it took us too long to set up events because we're a volunteer collective, but the reason it took us time to set up the events is because we had to invite, it was a program of inviting every nonprofit that wanted to participate, yep. So we had to give notice to them. And, you know, it would have been easily solved by just marking on the calendar months ahead of time when we were going to do it.
Which police officer gave you this concern, this so-called concern?
Well, this was from the deputy police chief, Rick Martinez, who had been corresponding with me a little bit about it.
He's a smooth-talking guy, as I remember. Yeah, I've talked to Martinez. He's always got a smile on his face, very good-natured, and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I don't know him at all personally. I know him. I have had a bad association with him in my mind from before, a few years ago, after some people smashed windows up on May 1st one night, and everybody started blaming Sabrosa without any evidence about it. And he was on the TV news saying things that weren't true, that the police said things that weren't true on the news. Also, the incident, I'm thinking, was in the paper. When the Sentinel claimed there had been a raid on Sabrosa, the police had raided Sabrosa, and that there had been complaints about the door being kicked in. And I work next door, and I'm there all the time, and I know what happened. Some police came. Sabrosa was closed. They never entered Sabrosa. They entered the People Power office and asked Micah, my coworker, and the current city council candidate a few questions. And he was like, I don't know, guys. You know, basically, this isn't Sabrosa. I don't know. And then they left, and that's all that happened. And then it came up in the paper that, and so I called the reporter. I was like, you know, what's going on? Like, none of this happened. Why are you printing this? He's like, well, that's what the police chief said. And he was quoted in the paper saying that. And so, you know,
Well, the police chief is Kevin Vogel. I hope you're not blaming poor Martinez for Vogel's statement.
Or whatever his exact status was at the time. That it was Martinez, I remember. That he was the one that was quoted in the paper at the time as saying that made up story about them raiding the place.
So you learned that they stopped giving bikes to you and you know to the bike church and transferred it to the bike dojo, and you attempted to get information from the assistant city manager, from Hillary Bryant, the vice mayor, from Don Lane, the mayor, and not able to get direct clear information, as I understand it. You tried to get the back emails to sort of kind of work through that yourself, which is something I'm trying to do around Hillary Bryant, because when I've corresponded with her, she's usually very tardy in her response, but she's nice, you know, superficially nice when you get the response, and I got the response back from her, but she's not really very responsive, and therefore you kind of got to do the research yourself. Have you been able to figure out why, what was going on with this sudden shifting?
None of that is still clear. So again, you know, the real quick recap. So the bike church, the city had this program for many years since the late 90s, and then for 4 years, the bike church had helped administer it. The police weren't that good at or didn't like dealing with all these bikes, but we helped them. We would invite the other groups. We would host it on our site. We distributed over 400 bikes in 16 events. And so this was a long relationship, and without ever any complaints on their end of any significant nature, then all of a sudden it just ended without any notification. We only realized months later, we're like, oh, we haven't had one of these in a while. We called them, and then I haven't been able to get a clear answer from any of them, and I started digging around. And actually, Robert, you had made the good suggestion of doing a public record request, and I found some information there, here, from people talking to people, and we pieced together what seems to be that a very strange story of this secret change without any notice to any of the prior participants, and it used to be a process that was open to any nonprofit in town, and now the bikes are going to a for-profit business that has a youth program, which Don Lane has described to me as a nonprofit effort, but they're not listed as a nonprofit. They don't promote themselves on their website as a nonprofit. You can't make a tax-exempt donation to them, so it's like. It seems like they give some bikes away, and they might work with the Beach Spots Community Center, other nonprofits, but they themselves are a for-profit business, and their youth program is, it's all about, like, buy a membership at the gym, and we'll give a bike away. And so it's, which isn't to say that it's not valuable, or I don't know much about it, but it's not. The program before required anyone to be a nonprofit, and it was open to all nonprofits. And so the whole thing seems bizarre. And then there was the thing about how, so the bike dojo's got a friend or business partner with Hillary Bryant's husband has this pedicab company, and that they're advertised themselves as being in conjunction with the bike dojo. And so, again, there's not like a lot of money to be made off of old bicycles, but there's the appearance of
impropriety.
People giving favors to their friends, and not only favors, but like in this case, kind of some. How and why exactly it changed, I don't know, but it feels to us like someone, canceled a perfectly good program that was working well to, like, help out a friend, or canceled a program that was working well, and then afterwards she helped out her friend, I don't know. But that was some of the documents we got said that Hillary Bryant had referred them to the bike dojo. But the most recent development is...
Before you give that, I think an additional aspect to this is that this may be a political move, because the bike church does give away bikes to poor people. And, I don't want to say that all police officers feel this way, but it has been suggested that the police may feel that you are providing bikes in a kind of criminal conduit to, an anarchist, poor section of town, whereas the more upscale bike dojo, gives them out to more middle-class people. I don't know how true this is. I'm wondering, what do you think of this claim?
I don't know much about the bike dojo's program and like how many bikes they actually give away, but it seems like at least one of the groups they collaborated with was the Beach Flats Community Center, which is serving relatively poor. I would assume the kids that want to come to get the bikes are probably the kids in the Beach Flats whose parents couldn't get them a bike, or otherwise they wouldn't be able to get one through the program because they'd already have their own bike. But regardless, I agree with your general concept that why do the police dislike us? We're this community institution. We're volunteer run. We've been helping reduce waste, teach people how to fix bikes, doing great service to the community for over a decade. And it's like, we should be getting an award. Why are they giving us a hard time? And I think it's because the majority of the council right now it doesn't like homeless people. And as my understanding is, since the murder of the woman on the Broadway or wherever it was by homeless men. That there's been some kind of like...
They're scapegoating and demonizing homeless people based upon Charles, whatever his name is.
Yeah, a single individual
crazy activities.
Kind of like all homeless people or whatever. My understanding is that there has been a lot of attacking against homeless service providers, too, or just like the idea that you're encouraging them, don't feed the pigeons or something like that.
Have you talked to Don Lane specifically about this idea that, as you asked him, is the police department just doesn't like the bike church because they think they're a bunch of, they're contaminated by being next door to the Sub Rosa Cafe, which has an anarchist library, or something to that effect?
I haven't been able to talk to Don Lane. I did ask him in an email why... He went down when this bike. It's kind of interesting. When I first emailed him to be like, "Hey, what's up with this?" The police chief said that the council had something to do with this change. Can you help me figure out what's going on? He says, "I'll look into it." And later, I saw a video on their website where Hillary and Don Lane were over there at the Bike Dojo for their first distribution to have this public proclamation, and Don Lane made of this, "Today is Project Bike Day," which is the youth program of the, and like, I wrote Don Lane, I was like, "Why are you proclaiming a day for them? Like, why don't you proclaim a day for us? We've been doing this great work for all these years," and I don't know, he didn't ever get back to me.
He didn't respond on that issue. You know, yeah. But you were about to go into what's happened recently. Kind of a great irony has been, apparently these bikes are being stored in a warehouse in Watsonville, and they're somehow now finding their way back to you. Explain to me how...
Yeah, so, well, some of them did. So this is the kind of foolishness of the whole thing, is that, like, you know, I mean, granted, our program was distributing them to lots of groups, but we would keep the junk at the end that nobody else wanted, because we're the best people to do that, because we're a recycling center. We help people fix bikes for themselves. We have a whole library of used parts to choose from for cheap, or people can earn stuff for free through volunteer work. So we're like, we are like the only group really set up to deal with large amounts of junky, you know, not fully functional bikes. And so the idea that this one group that's not collaborating with all the other groups in town could do that wasn't really sensible anyway, and it's proven to be true, because so they started probably in January or February. Our last distribution was in January, so since January they've been getting all these bikes, and the guy who owns the bike dojo told me himself that they were storing some of them in a warehouse. It turned out to be in a warehouse actually on the west side in the old Wrigley building, and the Al family, which is, you know, they own a ton of commercial real estate, and they're really... you know, pretty well to do, but they're also really socially aware and try to help out the community in different ways. And they have actually given free space in a warehouse in Watsonville to this group that has a bike project. We helped them get started. The bike church helped them get started, called the Bike Shack. And they work in conjunction with the Brown Berets. So that, you know, the Al family has a relationship with the Brown Berets and the Bike Shack, and they give them space actually. And so somehow they got connected with this other thing, and they don't know all the politics. I mean, they're like, "Oh, cool, a youth program? Sure, we've got." And they let them pile up their bikes in the corner of this empty warehouse, and that was happening for months. Well, I don't know if it was totally free or if they're getting a reduced rate. I don't know that detail, but they certainly weren't paying market rate, because what happened is they found a tenant, and they're like, "Okay, we can't. This is not going to be an empty warehouse anymore. You're going to need to find somewhere else for the bikes." So this just happened, you know, last week. So the Bike Dojo was scrambling to, what am I going to do with, like, there was actually 200, you know, bicycles, including the very broken down ones as bicycles, counting, you know, a mix of totally dysfunctional to almost working bikes. And, you know, he had already taken off the best ones for his program, but then the Al family's like, "Oh, well, there's this great program in Watsonville. It's called the Bike Shack." And so they came and took a bunch of them, filled up a U-Haul, got, you know, 70, 80, 90 bikes, I don't know. And then they were, like, full, and so they invited us, and we got some of them. And it's just ironic, because it's like...
I mean, you were invited not by the Bike Dojo, but by the Bike Shack.
The Bike Shack, who were friends with us, we helped them get started. We've supported them in a lot of ways.
And so what happened was...
So they invited us, and then that same day, well, we were, like, happy to take them, but it was like, we're here advocating for this public, transparent process. So we're like, well, we can't really justify just hanging on to them, and then... not saying anything about it. We, you know, we're wanting transparency. So while we were there, we've also been working with Micah, who, you know, former director of People Power, now city council candidate, and he can actually get Don Lane to answer the phone. So he was calling the city on our behalf, and like kind of saying, you know, these bikes, one way or another, ended up at the bike church, and they want to give them away like they used to. And is that okay? And if not, you all should go pick them up, because they can't store it forever, you know. And so, it turned out there were so many bikes left, even after the bike shack had taken a U-Haul full, that it was going to take us two loads. And by the time we got back for the second time, all those wheels started rolling in the city, and the city manager found out, and this guy from the Bike Dojo, Rob, they called him, and he got real angry, and he went over there, and he could have, none of these bikes should go to the bike church, and he, like, they locked it up and wouldn't let us take all of them. Which, I mean, whatever, that's just silly drama. But the thing is that's just really kind of ironic, like, and amusing to me, is like, you know, the city, for whatever reason we still aren't clear on that, but that I, you know, suspect that there's people that don't like us for whatever reason, and they try to find somewhere else to give the bikes, and they end up at our place anyway.
Let me interrupt you, because it sounds like there's a political motive here. I mean, you know, or at least there's a certain sort of political implications. Bikes are piling up by this other group that supposedly is more effective, according to the police department, than you are. I should ask you, how soon after you got bikes in the last few years were you able to get rid of them? How long did it take you on the average to get rid of 100 bikes?
Well, we would do it more frequently. See, these have been piling up for months, so...
Did that happen to you at any point when you
were... No. They would bring over 40 to 60 at a time, and we would get at least half of them. The best ones would get picked in this very same day, and the groups would take them, and the other ones we'd fold into our network within the several days.
So you weren't filling up a warehouse with old bikes that were being put in your program so that another program couldn't have them.
Yeah, exactly.
But that's the issue.
Really,
I mean,
foolish.
They're trying to punish your program for one reason or another. It sounds suspiciously likely that it would be political, and what's happening, ironically, it's completely screwed up so that the group that they're giving it to, the police department doesn't even care that those bikes aren't getting out into the community. The city council doesn't give a shit that the bikes aren't getting out because they're piling up. And then when you go and try to help remove them and you've gotten the permission of the Brown Berets and the bike folks, the bike shack, then you get this guy storming in and locking the warehouse. And, you know, you may call it a drama that's sort of secondary, but it's not really. It's an assertion.
Well, it's interesting because later that day,
that was his initial response.
He must have been getting heat from the after. I'm not sure that the city council knew they were all piling up in a warehouse. Like, my sense has been that a few people might know about some of this stuff, and a lot of them just like don't care and are not willing to go look into it for us. But I think the fact that this whole weird scenario where they were piling up and then we were the only good destination in town for a lot of them anyway, that I think that it did push back. And then at least what I heard indirectly, it's all like Micah heard from Don Lane that eventually later in the day, the guy, the owner of the bike dojo, was like kind of like, okay, I release control over those bikes. But so far no one's called us back to say we could have them yet.
Piling up in the warehouse? I mean,
I don't know, because he had to get them out of that warehouse because someone else is moving in, so I don't know what's happening with them.
Are they still locked up in the Brown Berets bike shack place?
Well, no. There's two separate places. The Brown Berets are in Watsonville, and they took as many as they could for their spot, and then the one where the bike dojo had them piling up is over an old Wrigley building, and I don't know anything about them. The truth is...
Has the bike church gotten any of those bikes?
We got half of the ones that were that one day that we, after the bike shack got what they wanted, they invited us. We took about half of what was left, and then the...
Have you been excluded since then?
Yeah, we have.
So they're continuing this lockout.
Evidently, but, in all honesty, we're just as well. That would have been a lot to take all at once, so it's worth pointing out, as you say, the kind of the ridiculousness of the situation that here we were able to use this and distribute them, and they won't let us. But pragmatically, like, it would be better if they came in 2 weeks after we've already moved out some of the stuff that we got the other day. But it is also interesting, when I first found out, the bikes are now going to this program called the Bike Dojo, I called the guy, Rob, and I was like, oh, I was just wondering about the program because we used to do it, and what's the nature of it? And he was really unfriendly and almost hung up without telling me anything. And I somehow got him to stay on the phone. And he, part of what I was asking him was, it seemed really unlikely to me that anyone else could actually use, like, sometimes half the bikes that come are total junk. Like, they're broken or they're just would take so much work to fix that no one would want to do it.
And this was a couple months ago you spoke to him?
Yeah, in June. Or maybe early July.
So he's been holding junky bikes since then without giving you access to them.
He offered in a weird way that if we came to pick it up, maybe. But the point is that, like, I was like offering to collaborate. We clearly wanted more than just to pick up his trash. But like I tried to engage with him about a month ago. So then then now he's accusing us of doing a smear campaign and disliking us so much that he would lock a warehouse. But. Anyway,
so,
yeah,
I mean,
but I do have, I don't know, that very same day all that nonsense was happening, the city manager, assistant city manager, who's supposed to have been charged with this for months, finally called to set up a meeting with me, and we had one, but then she canceled and rescheduled. So hopefully next week we'll have a meeting with this. I'm supposed to meet with the assistant city manager and with Deputy Chief Martinez, and then we'll see what. And I'm actually, I invited them. Well, why don't we meet at the bike church? And they said they would come down. So hopefully they don't cancel this one.
And if they don't, you can keep working on bikes, I guess. You know.
Yeah.
I guess the issue seems to me is, are bikes getting to poor people and people who need them? And if there's something in the way, like Hillary Bryant or I was accused by Hillary Bryant's friends of smearing her and lying about her. This is at the last city council meeting 2 weeks ago, the last regular city council meeting. They're holding special ones now that don't allow you to make oral communication statements. At least that's what happened on Tuesday. But, I said, well, I just got this information from Steve Schnarr that, you know, there were some concerns about this and he's already apologized for all his misstatements and his lies. And I said, well, what lies are you talking about? And I couldn't quite get a clear answer out of them about, you know, what was a lie, what was actually. Anyway, you know, I mean, sometimes people do have misunderstandings with each other. People can get heated over issues. But sometimes there is a clear class line being drawn, and I frankly tend to look for that line. Maybe I look for it too much, you know. But do you see a class line here? Do you see an economic issue here, or is this just sort of a misunderstanding?
That's what I think is likely, but since we haven't got any clear answers from anyone, it's hard to say. But it certainly, you know, that's my feeling about it, but there's also some people think, and this is probably part of the picture too, that the police don't like us because we're next door to Sabrosa.
I mean, another issue is when you tried to find this out, you couldn't get the emails that Hillary Bryant had in discussions on this issue, which is a public issue, an issue of public concern to the public. Emails that were being secreted away in private accounts, which I've seen this done with other council members in the last decade. And Lane, to his credit, says he has opened up his own email account. It's all public, which I think is great, and I think actually should be a requirement, and may, in fact, in a certain sense, be a requirement, although I don't think it's actually under the law a requirement.
You're saying his own personal email?
No. If Don Lane is getting in his personal email communications about city council business,
he has
to make that public. I mean, that's bullshit that he doesn't. Let me put it this way. It might not be the law, but it's something that every person in this community should demand of every city council member.
Yeah,
so we have a transparent process. So, Brian.
It's kind of interesting because Don is kind of really closing ranks with other city council members to say what, the, you know, kind of. He put out a response on behalf of the city council because we released an email about this issue, and then we got a lot of heat back about it. But a lot of people got mad and wrote letters to the council, be like, "What are you doing? Like, you should give the bikes the way they used to." And Don Lane addressed this issue on behalf of the whole council about Hillary Bryant's emails. Oh, those were just, you know, because she's part of their gym and it was the club. And you know, I mean, it could be true. It seems unlikely to me. And Don Lane also said other things that I know for sure are not true in his response. He said things that were just outright false. So,
you know, I'd appreciate it if you would itemize those things clearly. I know that's, you know.
Yeah,
not...
well, he said, I mentioned one earlier where he described them as a nonprofit effort.
Right.
So it could be that this is a new phrase he came up with, nonprofit effort, as opposed to a nonprofit organization or a nonprofit, because they're not, as far as I can tell. I haven't
found
any
evidence.
Right,
you mentioned that before. Any other misstatements?
But the other one was that he said, because I had written him the email that had, and people had got them out about it, that, and I had talked about this connection between Dave Schumann, Hillary Bryant's husband, and the Bike Dojo, and how they had a business relationship, and he said that it was just not true, there was no business relationship. And I was like, if you go to the website, unless they've changed it in the last week, if you go to the website of Cruisin' Pedicab, it says right on the front, it says, in association with the Bike Dojo. So, again, you know, I think some people thought I was, like, implying that Hillary Bryant was getting kickbacks or something, and I just don't, I've never thought that. Anyone, you know, there's not a lot of money in the world of used bikes. Although, you know, on these during these distributions, sometimes out of the 50, there might have been two or three or four that were actually pretty nice and could have sold for several hundred dollars if they were fixed up. But in general, we're not talking about a huge amount of money. And it was more about, like, illustrating a connection of a friendship or whatnot.
And also, as we were saying, and this is my issue, the lack of transparency. I mean, I think this is more broadly important, as you know, because I've been sending you copies of the emails I've sent to Hillary Bryant just to find out, even to answer the simple question, are you keeping city business private by putting it into your private emails? She won't give me a straight answer. So my response has been, good, send me all emails that have having to do with city business in the last year, and I can determine whether you're privatizing it or not. I'll have to do the work. You won't tell us or give us a straight answer. Maybe we shouldn't even believe you if you do, because not because Hillary is necessarily any more of a liar than any other politician, but politicians are known to be, particularly when they rely on the advice of City Attorney John Barisoni, you know, it can be very evasive depending on which way they want an issue to be viewed. And so, you know, I'm concerned that they're broadly, that the public, this be opened up to the community. And I think this exemplifies how the process is closing down, not opening up.
Yeah, there's some thing I could say about that. It's interesting. So, you know, originally I'd asked for can I please have any communications about the bike distribution program or communications with the city council or police and the bike dojo and stuff. And this was the whole thing that I got. The records coordinator at the city called me to delay the process. Oh, well, there's a council member that wants to know, do you really want them all? And there's several dozen of them. And then it turned out that I hardly got any. So I wrote her back and she's like, oh, well, actually, you know, those were private and unrelated to city business. So then I asked her a series of follow-up questions, including, could you please tell me who the unnamed city council member is, which was Hillary Bryant. And I asked for all various ways to get information about the guidelines around public officials and city council members in particular operating, you know, in a transparent way, and like, what are the rules about it, and do they have to conduct all business on public emails, and et cetera, et cetera. And she hasn't really given me anything about that. She like linked me to the city council member handbook, which was like a, you know, several hundred page document, and I couldn't easily find anything that dealt with what I was asking her about. And I wrote her back and was like, you know, thanks, but I don't really see what I'm finding here. Could you point me to the part of it that answers my question? And she never did. So,
you know, the staff, I think, is really, we like to blame the city council because we think that we can somehow hold them accountable because you vote for them every 2 years and the person with the most money wins. You know, that's very nice. So you can't hold them accountable. But the real people that need to be held accountable, as I often say on this show, are the city manager and the employees under him or her. In this case, it's a him, Martine Bernal. I know that, you know, several years ago, I was able to walk into the city offices and say, look, which city council members do this shifty business of telling people to send emails to their personal accounts so then they can pretend that, that, you know, they aren't city business, even if they are. And I got a list of those people like 3 or 4 years ago, you know, but I haven't tried that recently. And apparently they got
4 years ago.
What's that?
Who was on the list?
You know, I think Cynthia Matthews was one of those people, but I don't want to swear.
You should look it up before we start.
I'd have to look it up, but my problem is because I, you know, run around doing so many things, I keep crappy records. I mean, they're all there. It's just a matter of finding them, and that's that can be difficult. You know, I actually may, because I probably refer to it in emails, and I keep a lot of old emails, so I can probably go back and look at it. But we shouldn't have to do that. We should be able to walk in fact, you know, to the city offices and say, you know, all right, you know, walk in with big flashlights and miner's helmets on with the big lights on the helmet saying, all right, we're looking for some, you know, throw some light on the subject. Give us a straight answer and call the media and get it that way. You know, I mean, why this idea of fucking around endlessly, waiting month after month to get response from unresponsive politicians, to me, I mean, this is exactly what the Occupy movement said we're not going to do. Occupy movement realized these politicians are a block to any kind of meaningful change. They are not the agents by which this change is going to happen. That's the reason I've advised people like Micah and Steve not to run for city council, because I think it's a waste of time in the sense that once you get on the city council, unless you have your own staff, you are stuck with their staff, and good luck.
It's a complicated world out there. I'm not that excited in the whole with the... with the electoral politics as the vehicle for change, but I get engaged on a lot of different levels. And I think actually it's important, especially on the more the local level of the city, we could have more influence than we can on the state level and the national level in terms of who we vote for. And I have actually been helping on Micah's campaign.
I'll try not to hold that against you, Steve.
Yeah. So I think that actually looking at the council as it is now and who's running and who with a you know good chance of winning, that it's likely to get worse. Even if Micah gets elected, we'll probably have a little bit worse of a council. And if he doesn't get elected, it could be quite a lot worse. So I think that it's important for people to vote for, you know, for city council. And I know. You know, Steve Pleich is also running.
Pleich rhymes with H.
What did I say?
Pleich.
Yeah.
Pleich.
Pleich. So, sorry.
That's okay.
I'm mispronouncing your name, Steve, but, you know, so yeah, I think it's important, and I mean, time will tell, but it's not going to hurt anything to go out there and vote for some good candidate.
You know, I probably kind of disagree with you. I mean, much as I like Micah personally, but you know, that's really a subject for another day. You've given us, you know, 40 minutes of your time at least. You were going to leave 20 minutes ago to get to an appointment.
Yeah, I got to be somewhere at 7:30, so yeah, it's about time for me to go. But thanks for having me, Robert.
Keep us advised, Steve, on the updates on this because it sounds like that we haven't heard the end of this controversy.
Well. I'd like to hope that we can get to a good resolution on Wednesday, but time will tell.
You will have the audacity of hope, won't you?
Yeah, all right. I'll see you, Robert.
Thanks, Steve. Bye-bye. And phone lines are open, 427-3772. What do you think of this bike brouhaha? Any comments from any listeners out there? Have you had any experiences yourself with problems trying to get straight answers out of city council members or city staff or, I don't know, trying to get alternative transportation? I don't exactly know the procedures of the bike church versus the bike dojo in terms of how a poor person would go about getting a cheap bike. But, you know, that seems to me to be not just environmentally sensitive, but it can be a way of actually getting around if you're, you know, poor. Of course, the problem is how long can you keep the bike? Often with no place to store it in a situation where theft is ever present and happening a lot, I'm hearing, it can be a real difficult situation. Let's take a Weaver break, and I'll be back again. The phone number here is 427-3772.
The cuckoo is a pretty bird. She sings as she flies. She brings us the tidings and tells us no lies. She feeds on the pretty flowers in the spring of the year and sings of my false love in a voice true and clear. A-walkin' and a-talkin', a-walkin' goes I to meet my false lover and hear him deny. But if I'm forsaken, I am not forsworn, and he's surely mistaken to think I shall mourn. For I can love little, and I can love long, and I can love a sweetheart till a new one comes along. I can hug him, I can kiss him, and prove my heart kind, and turn my back on him, and likewise my mind. A-walkin' and a-talkin', a-walkin' goes I to meet with my true love. We'll meet by and talk together is all my delight. To walk and talk together from evening till night.
Yeah, that was another one from the Weavers. A walkin' and a talkin'. You're listening to Free Radio, 101.3 FM. I'm Robert Norris. The name of the show is Bathrobes, Pierres, Broadsides. We're talking about poverty issues and other stuff, too. I tend to do reports from all over the state when I get them, as you can hear. And insofar as they impact poor people, hopefully specifically poor people here, but also poor people elsewhere. I've been doing some occasional reports from Fresno, where you can find more of that on the Santa Cruz Indie Media, actually the indiebay.org/Central Valley, Central Valley Indie Media website. There, Mike Rhodes of the Community Alliance has been documenting police harassment of the much larger encampments that have developed under the freeways and so forth and been driven away by the city, although only after a significant period of time because the homeless won a large lawsuit there. But let's take this call before I go into that. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Robert.
Hello, Uncle Robert. David Silva.
David Silva, or Dead On Silva, as I've called you in the past.
Yeah, I heard some people expressing on your show some doubt about voting, and that's certainly understandable. When I was a young man, my very first opportunity to vote, I got to choose between Johnson and Goldwater. And wrote in somebody. But I want to encourage people to always vote, because you can always lower their percentage of victory, which lowers their percentage of ego, which gives us a little bit more of a handle on democracy. So do whatever we can. Don't let them steal your vote away from you by giving you truly D and truly dumb all the time. I didn't do some right parties, do blank ballots, lower their percentage of victory.
Mm-hmm.
Keep the faith.
Okay, David. I'm not telling people not to vote. In fact, you know, for all those Obama lovers, what I tell them when I say, oh, Obama, you know, the guy who introduced drone murder and legally enshrined constitution shredding, that Obama, the guy who's engaged in more attacks on whistleblowers than any other president in history, that guy, you know, they say, oh, yeah, you know, that's a real problem. But, you know, what about Romney, you know, is what I always get. And so I say, you know, whatever you do on voting day is your own business. But certainly don't give these people, both these candidates, a pass on the issues that are really important and that both of them are, you know, essentially corporate whores taking huge amounts of corporate money. And call that out. And then if, you know, when it comes around, you just devise your own political strategy, but don't run around marching like an idiot, like an Obamadoid or an Obamaton, as I used to call him. You know, I want to sing about, I don't, you don't have to sing about Romney in this area because, you know, nobody really that I'm talking to probably wants to vote for Romney. Probably a lot of Republicans don't want to vote for Romney either. But, you know, it's a phony choice, as the caller suggests, Tweedledee or Tweedledum. One of the reasons to vote is that you have initiatives, some of which need to be defeated, some of which should be passed. I'm hoping you can have a show on that. But even the initiatives are, you know, it's a money-based deal. I mean, you've got huge, and you've got people who can put, when the good initiative gets on the ballot, somebody else can spend, a corporation made a huge amount of money and put a similar initiative on the ballot that screws up the first initiative. It doesn't mean it's all hopeless, but it means it's a difficult task, to be sure. And more important than what you do on an election day is what you do the rest of the time. You know, you're being given the illusion that you're somehow giving your consent to all this mass murder abroad and the repression at home because you have the right to vote. It's just despicable. And it's an illusion. Don't buy it. Don't follow it. Fresno report. In Fresno, homeless activists in Santa Cruz, we had a HUF meeting yesterday, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. We meet every Wednesday. And we're trying to figure out what to do about the ongoing destruction of homeless campsites, seizure and destruction of homeless property, ticketing of homeless people that's going on. And Although it's true in the latest SCPD report, if you look on the SCPD Santa Cruz Police Department blog, you find nothing past week 10, which I think was September 17th. On the September 24th, there's no kind of update that shows you more ticketing and more hassles. But they did say that they were going to continue the program, that it was a successful one, and they're going to keep on going. So it's hard to tell exactly what they're doing, but it is certainly true from the anecdotal reports I'm receiving that there is this causing great amounts of hardship, and it's abusive in the extreme, obviously. I mean, it doesn't even need, it shouldn't even need to be said. In Fresno, when this kind of thing happens, organizations come together, and it's a much larger city, so there's a much larger number of people, though not necessarily a larger percentage there, who really are put themselves out to do things like provide legal support, come down and document the criminalization of poor people and the destruction of homeless tents and property and campsites. Here's this Fresno report I got from Mike Rhodes, or actually he was simply writing to other Fresno activists. He writes, the Community Alliance, which provides portable toilets at the two largest homeless encampments in downtown Fresno, can always use more toilet paper, because if we don't have any, the people in the encampments will use whatever is available, like clothing, which clogs up the portable toilets. Donations of TV can be dropped off, and so on and so on. Hours are, so on and so. If you're going to the homeless encampments to drop off food, water, or other things, we would appreciate it if you would stop by the Fresno, I guess, Nonviolence Center and help pick up some TP to distribute. Then the second thing that Mike Rhodes notes is the city of Fresno has removed all their trash containers from the homeless encampments. So garbage is starting to create not only a visual blight, but a sanitation problem and a health hazard. I'm going to divert the money, Rhodes writes. We have for the portable toilets to start cleaning up the piles of garbage that are accumulating. If anyone would like to make a contribution, do it for the Homeless Sanitation Project. And this, of course, is something that could be done in Santa Cruz if people could get together on a campsite and just be there. But, of course, the city has not authorized any of these encampments. They just formed. Then they get dispersed and they form somewhere else. And essentially supporters follow them around and provide dumpsters and porta potties wherever they are, because that's where people are. That's where people are trying to live and survive. And that could be done here in Santa Cruz as well, if we had the wherewithal, the organization, the enthusiasm. There is, you know, growing awareness of the abusiveness of how homeless people are treated and the absurdity of the statements made by politicians and even social service providers, or so-called social service providers, about what the real situation is. I mean, perhaps one of the worst things that Don Lane's legacy will have proven to give us is he's a guy who stood up as some sort of homeless supporter. I mean, if you listen to his speech last year when he became the mayor, 50% of it was taken up by praising homeless concerns. And of course, he didn't talk about civil rights at all, because that would mean he could actually do something about that. He wouldn't need money. He'd just need to stand up and speak at city council. He might not win, but at least he'd raise his voice. But since he's voted against the civil rights legislation, and in fact for legislation that cuts down homeless civil rights, he naturally can't do that. But when he passes on one way or another, what will be left behind him is this legacy of hypocrisy, and that's what's so sad. You can't trust the poverty pimps, is what folks are going to have to draw from his example. The poverty pimps, you know, those who run around raising money on the backs of the homeless for middle class positions or to support themselves. I don't think Lane is doing that financially to support himself. But the people he associates with, the deals he makes, the claims he makes, the evasions that his failure to address such things as this disability controversy out at the Homeless Lack of Services Center, where they're turning away disabled people, they're not providing rules that of appeal if people are turned away, they're not, as I understand it, even following state regulation in terms of how disabled people are supposed to be treated there, and they're not accepting the concerns and complaints of people who are advocating for those people. I'm not really one of those folks, so this isn't, you know, I'm not saying they're specifically turning away me, although when I try to talk to Lane about it publicly, in terms of a debate or a forum, he refuses and starts denouncing me. He says he'll talk with somebody else, but that other person he's refused to have a debate on with as well, or at least that has certainly not come up, and I understood it's been proposed to him. That's John Colby. Also, kind of on the horizon, or actually as I, on the horizon as I look back, is this Aptos Safeway controversy, which I spoke to Rodney Hoffer about. He's the owner of Ace Hardware out there in the Rancho Del Mar Shopping Center. I'm not a big fan of some of the merchants out in the Rancho Del Mar. I don't know about anything about Rodney. I know that Gottschalk's, the coffee roasting company, the Sheriff's Substation, and Safeway were all abusive toward homeless people and their advocates and youth advocates who are out there, Jerry Henry and Scott Rhodes and Richard Quigley, who were supporters of the civil rights of young people and the civil rights of homeless people out there, were put through an incredible legal roller coaster by some of those merchants and some of the deputies. But I ran into some folks at this meeting of the Safeway. Safeway was trying to do a schmoozing session with the community that was outraged that there's this huge mega Safeway that is displacing a dozen or more businesses, and they were organizing to just say no to this in some way. And there seemed to be a lot of spirit. People walked out of the meeting to form their own meeting. It became clear that all Safeway wanted to do was schmooze people to death and shut down any dissent and have their professional managers manage people. So I was kind of hopeful there might be some real community movement here. But when I talked to Rodney about 3 or 4 days ago, it was last week, I was very disheartened. He was disheartened too. He said he unfortunately is a tenant of Safeway, and you know they have his lease, so he is on a leash as well, although he wasn't going to give up his position. And he did write this article, this letter, and it's, I guess it's online for the tpgonlinedaily.com. Safeway plans are a disaster for Aptos. The $44 billion a year corporation Safeway came to Aptos with their briefcase of money and bought the Rancho Del Mar Shopping Center. Their dream is to build a 60,000-foot mega Safeway. Obviously, their pitch is how bad the current center is. It is termite-infested. It is not energy efficient. It must be torn down. Do they know that half of Aptos buildings have termites? Should we tear down all of Aptos? If we are truly concerned about the environment and energy efficiency, they would not tear it down. They would remodel and put in energy-efficient features and new lighting for the existing tenants. The tenants would certainly appreciate that. Unfortunately for the tenants in the Rancho Del Mar Center, Safeway is now the landlord and the developer. When Safeway did their megastore expansion in the Almar Center on the west side of Santa Cruz, the tenants at the Almar Center had a separate landlord that looked out for their tenants and ensured that any tenant that was affected was given another space in the center. Normally, the landlord wants to work with the tenants and help make their business successful. That is not the situation at the RDM, Rancho Del Mar Center. Safeway's number one priority is the role of the developer. The developer views the current tenants as an obstacle in reaching their goal. They would like to get rid of the tenants, but they need to be smooth enough to still look good to the public. To accomplish this, they will try to slowly kill off the tenants that are in their way of the development by, one, raising the tenants' occupancy costs by 30% over what they were 6 months ago. In this poor economy, when sales are what they were 6 years ago, a 30% increase is a serious blow and would kill many businesses. And two, giving the tenants only a one-year lease. Many businesses buy their goods at least 6 months in advance. The businesses will stop buying in advance because they don't know if they will be around. Businesses will stop advertising. Half the reason you advertise is for the future. An example is the Yellow Pages. You sign up today for next year's book. If you're not in a business a year from now, you still have to pay through the next year. With no future, the business will stop investing in their business. The 14 businesses in their way have a tough time ahead of them. The businesses left standing are in just as tough a situation. There are approximately 28,000 shoppers per day that patronize the 14 businesses being demolished. That is 90,000 shopping experiences per month. That accounts for about 60% of the center activity, not counting Safeway. When the 14 businesses are demolished, sales for the left-standing businesses will drop about 20%. When Safeway moves to the Dream Safeway space below the center, sales will drop another 5%. The left-standing businesses should expect their sales to drop 25%. These figures are at minimum and not taking into account the Aptos residences giving up on going to what is left of the Rancho Del Mar Center. The parking lots will be torn up. The sidewalks and storefronts will be plywooded over during that phase of the project. Although Safeway may already have plans to tear down the left-standing buildings, why let those buildings remain when they have all the problems of the tear-down buildings? Safeway is so adamant that the tenants are paying below normal rent, chances are the left-standing tenants will have additional rent increases of a minimum 10% over the next 3 years. Add to the already increased rent of 30% plus another 10% increase, rent is now 40% up. Few of the left-standing businesses will survive a 25% decrease in sales, a 40% increase in rent, and one more item, their anchor store, Safeway, is not really a part of the center anymore. A major reason a tenant pays a big money rent is because there is a major tenant in the center. Safeway will be in their own dream space with their own parking lot, far removed from the rest of the shops. If the project is finished at the end of 2016, expect it to take at least 3 years to find tenants to fill all the empty spaces. The Rancho Del Mar Center will not be back to having the number of retail stores and restaurants that it has today until the year 2020. Evidence is with the Westside Santa Cruz Almar expansion. The expansion was completed 2 years ago, and at the current time, only 40% of the spaces that Safeway is responsible for are leased. Safeway is so big that having their spaces sit empty for 2 years seems to be okay with them. They are making their bucks with their new store. Safeway has the know-how to figure out a way to expand their existing store in their current location. It has been made very clear to Safeway by the residents of Aptos that Aptos does not want a mega Safeway. Safeway bought some dirt and the buildings that stand on it. Safeway did not buy Aptos. And that's an article by a guy who I thought was leading, he's probably still in his own way, is leading the opposition to the mega Safeway being developed in Aptos. Rodney Hoffer is the owner of Ace Hardware in the Rancho Del Mar Shopping Center. I invited Rodney to come on the air. He said he was apprehensive about doing it because of his lease. He didn't want his lease revoked, even though he's quite critical of Safeway here. And I'm still. He did, however, recommend someone else who would be. He said he would put me in touch with. That hasn't happened yet. If it does, I may be coming back to this issue. There's a lot of stuff happening in Greece and Spain, which I hope other broadcasters on free radio are covering. I know probably other broadcasters elsewhere in the country and the world are covering it in some detail. So I'm not going to talk too much about that at all. I don't really have a lot of expertise in the area. I'm always glad to see when people are in the streets standing up against this machine of austerity run by the international banks and by the IMF and, by the powers that be. I noticed a couple of sort of interesting bits that I was reading earlier today. It was about Barack Obama and Winston Churchill. And it was written by a guy called Vijay Prashad, who is a counterpunch writer. And he's author of This Concerns Everyone, In the Arab Spring, Libyan Winter, a recent book. If Obama is to be castigated as an anti-colonial radical, it is seemingly acceptable among U.S. conservatives to embrace an Anglo-Saxon heritage and Churchill. Those who know anything of India's anti-colonial fight recognize that the villain of the peace, the Indian fight for independence, was Winston Churchill. His words from May 1943 should be embroidered into a tapestry to hang near the mirrors of every Indian household to remind us of his perfidy. "I hate Indians," he said. "They are a beastly people with a beastly religion." The context for this outburst was straightforward. A famine stalked the land in Bengal. This had been produced by the removal of vast quantities of foodstuff to feed the British population and the troops in West Asia and North Africa, as well as to build up a stockpile in case of the imminent collapse of Nazi Germany. Even at the height of the famine, Churchill blocked the diversion of ships of grain from Australia to Calcutta. As Macharusi Mukherjee writes in her important study of the famine, Churchill's Secret War, the sole sacrifice that ordinary Britons were asked to make in response to the shipping crisis of 1943 was to eat multigrain bread. Meanwhile, in Bengal, between 1 and 5.4 million people died. At the War Cabinet meetings, if anyone raised the question of the Bengal famine, Churchill would fulminate about, quote, British workmen in rags struggling to pay rich Indian mill owners. As Field Marshal Wavell put it, Churchill hates India and everything to do with it. Dismayed by the lack of dialogue with the British, Gandhi and the Congress had begun the Quit India movement in 1942 and then gone to jail. There, Gandhi began one of his many fasts. Churchill revealed in the Mahatma's near death, quote, or he reveled in it, and he said, "We should be rid of a bad man and an enemy of the empire." That's Winston Churchill talking about Gandhi. When asked to make some compromise with the nationalists, Churchill said that, quote, "This was not the time to crawl before a miserable little old man who had always been our enemy," unquote. 2 years later, in 1945, Churchill told his private secretary that, quote, "The Hindus are a foul race," and that he wished Air Chief Marshal Arthur Bomber Harris could, quote, "send some of his surplus bombers to destroy them." This is Romney's here. Romney's making favorable comments about Winston Churchill. The colonialist to the very end. So, I don't know. I always find it interesting to see these great heroes of the past essentially cut down to size, or at least illuminated for what they really are, or what certainly a part of what they really are is. I'm going to do some playing now. I've been having a lot of trouble with my audio recorders, and I'm shifting my technology, but it's taking a while. So what I'm going to do here is play some bits that I wish I had the full interviews of, but I've got a little something here, and I'm going to try to give you a few voices from the street before I wander out of the studio in the next 25 minutes from now. If you have any thoughts and you'd like to call in, the phone number here, again, is 427-3772, and do that, please. By the way, I got the word from a homeless activist who came to the Huff meeting yesterday, a homeless guy, that the current director, Chris, I think his name is it Edler? I'm not sure. But I know his first name is Chris, who's taken over the sort of management of the Paul Lee Loft, which is not apparently closing down as we had thought it was, because the Page Smith Community House, into which is supposed to be sending all its people into the Paul Lee Loft and so shutting off any further outside entry to the Paul Lee Loft, which is 46 spaces for people if you can get on the waiting list and you wait 2 to 6 weeks and that sort of thing. But you're able to, you know, get a bed for a month if you are able to follow all the rules or follow the monitor's dictates, depending on, no matter what the rules are, I guess. That's become the concern of some people anyway that have come to me. But there has been a concern that I've raised in past shows, which is that because the law now states in Santa Cruz that the law that says you're illegal if you sleep after 11 o'clock at night in your vehicle on any public property, even if it's legally parked, or if you sleep outside on any public property, even if you're creating no health and safety hazard at all, out of sight, out of mind, still illegal. That tickets given to you for that will be dismissed if you're on the waiting list of the Homeless Lack of Services Center or the River Street Shelter. And that was created due to the good work of Peace Camp 2010. They didn't actually ask for that. They asked for more. And the city attorney went scuttling to create this, in perhaps in the fear that there would be lawsuits later, because it was clear there were plenty of homeless people on the steps of the county building, on the steps of the courthouse, rather. They had no place to go, and yet they were being ticketed and harassed by the county authorities. That might have been another reason that the city didn't move in initially to go after them, though it certainly did later when the protest moved to City Hall in September of 2010. Any case, we have tried for several years to get the Homeless Lack of Services Center to give out a little piece of paper that says, you're on the waiting list, so that a person, when the cop arrives with his flashlight in the middle of the night, shows up and says, get up, get out, you got it. Here's a ticket for you. You say, wait, look, I'm on the waiting list. And it was pointed out by
I don't know, people who are trying to be to defend the homeless lack of services center, that this wouldn't necessarily stop the police. And they first have to have a meet and confer session with the cops, talk it over with the police and all that sort of thing, the homeless lack of services center, before they could, you know, start giving out these little receipts or pieces of paper that document, these little documents that say, this guy's on the waiting list, leave him alone. Come on. He's got no legal place to sleep. Leave him alone. The Great Homeless Lack of Services Center apparently has a lack of paper. They don't want to do this. And then when it's brought to the attention of the community, they lie about it. At least Monica Martinez does. She's the head of the Homeless Lack of Services Center, the executive director. On at least two occasions, she's publicly lied about it. And I was surprised to hear yesterday that there was a secondhand account that this homeless guy's friend had gotten a piece of paper that indicated he was on the waiting list. But I want to make sure, I want to see it before I start celebrating, although it's not really much cause for celebration because the police can still ignore these pieces of paper. But it does at least indicate that after all these years, there has been some final move by the Homeless Lack of Services Center to recognize that this is the obvious thing to do, that it's going to help more people to do this, and that it might offend certain police officers who don't like the idea of being told, hey, you should respect some human rights sometimes every so often. But that's how it goes. So many people don't want to offend the police department that you get these things like this bike dojo bullshit, which, who knows, it might well have come out of the police department instead of the city council or other parts of the city staff. It's not, you know, it's hard to say where it came from because it's all been concealed and hidden. We don't know. So, in any case, here's a little something from the street. I believe this, if I'm not mistaken, well, this I believe is a street jeweler talking, but I could be wrong. Let's see.
Nunez is holding part of the support the Santa Cruz 11.
No, actually, this is an earlier tape. Sorry. This is a tape which was made on a Friday some weeks ago when the Santa Cruz 11 banner was raised near the Women in Black downtown, which has a demonstration every Friday against the Palestinian oppression that's going on, the oppression of the Palestinians by the Israeli government and the occupation. There's also oppression going on in Santa Cruz against political prisoners who are at liberty at the moment, but we face these huge jail sentences and endless court appearances and high court costs and all that stuff. So here's a little dialogue that happened on the corner as we stood there with our banners.
Holding a multicolored peace flag. Mel, do you ever get tired? I see you giving out bagels on Monday at the Calvary Episcopal. It's Friday. Don't you ever realize these meaningless peace protests only lead to greater wars? Why don't you support your leaders in this matter? Or let things work through the political system. Obama is running for president.
President of what?
The United States. These United States.
Say, can you see?
Go ahead.
I don't believe in it anymore. I'm sorry. But I just try to, I'm a groupie. I need to hang out with people that have some hope and some soul and some clear thinking. And that's where I am today. And that's the end of my story.
Thank you. We've been talking with
Mel.
Thank you, Mel. So we have a man who is not being harassed, but who was warrant checked. How did that go down?
Well, they discovered that I did have a warrant in San Luis Obispo, but they decided that they didn't want to export me all the way down.
Just
to
murder, rape?
No, it's for camping.
Camping?
Yeah.
That's worse. You're ruining the businesses of poor San Luis Obispo and how you come to destroy the businesses of Santa Cruz.
Well, I try and keep it hidden. That's what they've advised me to do. They say, as long as you're hidden, out of sight, out of mind. I try to be peaceful about it.
And have you been successful? Because there have been a lot of police, shall we say, beating the bushes, I've noticed. I've heard.
Some of them do beat the bushes, but I have been successful thus far. I have been able to find a corner bush.
So you've gotten no citations yourself?
No, not locally.
How long have you been here?
I've been here About a week.
And is this your first time through the Holy Cross, so to speak?
No, I've been here before.
Saints Crossing, actually. And we're having a bit of technical difficulties, but have no fear, that will be resolved very shortly.
Since I was a teenager.
And have you, I always ask this question, do you notice any differences between your early days and now?
Basically, I think the atmosphere and the climate is the same as it was in the 60s. You know, it's similar, but people are more aware of it. A lot of it's come to the surface, because back then it was kind of a movement, but now it's kind of a process of individuation, but it's no longer the me generation.
Now it's
not just
the Vietnam War, it's the Afghani War, the Iraqi War, the potential Iranian War, and the other wars. So it's kind of the big war has kind of spawned a bunch of little wars.
That is true.
And,
you know,
the Democratic peace guy, Obama, is creating more wars. What do you make of that?
I think that what is mentioned in the Holy Scriptures is true, that he came to visit us, the living God, not very long ago. And the net analysis is, an imperious forest woman has broken my heart.
And I will use my sensorial tape-stopping ability, because what I want to do is not only avoid what's being discussed on that tape, which isn't terribly important either way. I guess we're going to have something about the end of the world and a whole show on that, although... Nah, I don't think so. There was a session at the Sub Rosa. There's another one happening tonight. It's an open mic session. Every Thursday there's an open mic at the Sub Rosa. If you go there, I think they ask you to come earlier, but it doesn't really start till 8 o'clock, as I understand it. You can go, you can sign up, you can sing, you can perform, you can speak. Who knows? Maybe you can do mime, whatever that is. However your fancies are. We had one evening which was devoted to the Santa Cruz 11 and political repression and the Occupy movement. I played some of it, and the parts I played were just not very good. But I found some better parts, and this again, we're not... I'm going to play a little bit from it tonight. This is somewhat tooting my own horn, although there's not a lot of particular discussion of the Santa Cruz 11, of which I'm one. But there's... There's some discussion about the need for solidarity in standing up against police repression of a lot of different political movement in this city that was largely incarnated in the Occupy movement of last year. But there's just all the new restrictions, the curfews at the various buildings, the public buildings, are an example of something that impacts everybody who wants to engage in direct political protest. And that the climate has gotten much more toxic, and so the fact that we have these kinds of speakouts is important. I'm going to play a bit of this.
Get my little smartphone working here. Okay, so my father...
This is Dennis Edler. Who's been an activist for many years, and who's also a teacher, I believe, is about to recite a poem, I believe.
That was a young poet and playwright back in the 1930s, and he wrote a lot of poetry detailing, you know, what was going on back then during the Depression years. You know, many of the same problems that we're faced with today. He wrote a book of these poems, and I mean, like, every one of them is still relevant. His name, Eugene Victor Epler, named after Eugene Victor Ditt.
Wow.
And so this poem is about an artist's protest that was held in New York in 1936, so we're talking about 75 or more years ago, when my father was a young man in his 20s. It's entitled Artist Protest, and I'll read a preamble that I wrote. which goes like this. The poem below is a dramatic recreation of an incident in which WBA artists protested the dismissal of nearly 2,000 of their ranks from WPA projects in New York City. As we enter into a new era in which a progressive social agenda has once again come to the fore, we must remember that the victories were won during the New Deal, the spread of industrial unionism, the establishment of Social Security, and later during the 50s and 60s, the civil rights movements, women's and anti-war movements, came about because people fought in the streets and the halls of justice, forcing their elective officials to respond accordingly. There's a contemporary newspaper account. The incident that the poem is based on was reported on in the New York Times. I was able to get an archive of that, and I have a PDF which I have online, which can be printed out. So the poem is as follows. It's entitled "Artists Protest." There we were, more than 400 of us, waiting to be received so we could lay down our demands. We should have known that they wouldn't see us. Well, we kind of expected it. So we made up our minds to stay until we would be seen. That was about 4:00 p.m. We made up our minds to stay the night through, and the next day too, we made up our minds to stay until we would be seen. And somebody, some big shot or other, he stood on a table and looked down at us. I felt like spitting in his eye, for he looked down at us with a sneer in his eye, and when he spoke, I felt like taking his neck in my hands and stopping the words that seemed to push their way out of his neck. For the words that he spoke to us who are trying to keep our jobs, fighting to keep our jobs so we can keep ourselves from falling into the dung heap of the jobless march, the words that he spoke, "Why don't you go home? Nobody's going to see you. So it ain't going to do you no good to hang around. Go on home like good little boys and girls. And if you don't, I'm warning you that if you're not out of here in an hour or two, I'm going to call the cops." And the word "cops" went stumbling through the crowd, and somebody from the crowd yelled out, "Oh, yeah, oh, well, policemen are sissies." And we all laughed, and the man on the table, he turned all green and white, his lips closed tight, seeing that we were prepared to fight for our jobs, our lousy jobs, our $23.86 jobs, and the minutes went by, and we linked our arms together into a human chain. There, the 400 of us, women and men, chained together in one united thought, together we'll fight for our jobs to keep our jobs. And the minutes went by, and as the minutes went by, we began to chant the song of demand, a song of demand which seemed to toss sand upon the wounds of the man that stood on the table, for suddenly he cried out, "I want you, I did," and we yell back, "Why don't they see us? We'll stay and only leave when all thin slips are rescinded. That we demand." And so there we stood as the minutes crept by, armed together by a common thought that we'd stand together, for we knew that through unity, and only through unity, could we make administrators, people, a city, a nation, a world, see that we mean to keep our jobs because we need our jobs, to keep us from falling into the dung heap of the jobless march. So closely knit together, together we stood, 400 stood, perched upon the 8th floor of a building that stood a challenge to our jobs. And then from below we heard the eerie song of sirens singing a song of police coming their way. And we knew the time had come when we 400 were to show our militancy to an unsuspecting world. "We'll stick together," we quoted to ourselves. "We won't leave," we shouted to ourselves. "Policemen are sissies," we comforted ourselves. "Let them come," we defied them to ourselves. "We shall not be moved," we challenged ourselves. And they came, streaming into that room, blue coats streaming into that room, and we looked at them as one would look at an enemy, and we tightened our grips amongst ourselves, strengthening a human chain made up of emotions far stronger than fists or clubs. And the mouth of a blue coat opened and it tossed words out at us. "Why don't you just go home," it said. "Why don't you be nice," it said. "You're just making trouble," it said. "Go on home," it said. And one of us in reply yelled, "We ate." And that about summed it up in a nutshell.
We ate.
Don't you know you've breaking the law? The mouth of the blue coat open and closed. The WPA only rented this space from 9 to 6. And you're staying here after 6 when you're supposed to leave. Only makers breaking the law open and closed the mouth of the blue coat. We're not going to leave. We're not going to leave until pink slips are rescinded. And above our chanting, we heard a whistle. And we felt the warmth of blue coats surging toward us. We linked our arms closer, tighter together, welding ourselves solidified into a forbearing human chain. And then they tried to pull us one by one out of that chain, and we wouldn't be moved. We'll show them our strength, not the strength of brutality, but the strength of unity. We won't be moved. They talk of Spain and the terror of fascism. They condemn Hitler and act shocked at the playful games of a Mussolini plays with the rights of a people. And they tell us, American citizens, that we should be proud and glad that we live in such a democracy and America, the land of the free. Well, those who talk, if they were but eyewitnesses to the goings-on on the 8th floor in a room surrounded by 4 walls and 1 door, a room enclosing 400 souls brutally attacked by New York's finest, for clubs were being wielded and fists were being used and men were throwing curses to the steady drip of workers' blood and women were screeching defiance to the steady beat of Cossacks' clubs. Oh yes, blood washed the floor, blood of workers, blood washed the floor, cleansing it of the trampled prints the police left. And the cries of the men and women which re-echoed against the walls remained to haunt those who had no desire to see men and women who demanded jobs, those men and women who remained to meet the clubs of the law as the clubs of the law met the bones of the people fighting for jobs. And the curses of the cops intermingled with the defiant cries of workers spelt the doom of American democracy. For the smell of fascism stank its way through that room, and the false little clubs beat a wooden tattoo upon the skulls and bones of innocent workers. The room that we entered was no more the same, for desks were overturned, typewriters battered to a pulp, papers strewn red by workers' blood, as triumphantly cops dragged us out and down the elevators into the yawning mouths of black mariahs. Triumphantly cops marched us out. The very bluecoats of New York's finest, they fought us with fists and clubs while we fought together, wielded together into a human train. No, we were not defeated. We have just begun to fight. So tossed into wagons, to be driven to stations, battered and slaughtered by the fists and clubs of brutality, we struck a new note for freedom, and together we sang America. As deep in our hearts we knew that the words betrayed us.
And that was Dennis Edler reading, I guess, his father's poem at a Thursday evening Sub Rosa session on August 16th, right before the preliminary readiness hearing that 7 of us of the Santa Cruz 11 had. And, you know, it's interesting. I'm looking at a story in the San Francisco Chronicle from a week ago by a right-winger, Chip Johnson, who writes a regular column, City Council Loses Control to Unruly Mob. And this kind of reminds me of that. The Oakland City Council can no longer control its own meetings, Johnson writes. And what he's writing is that a bunch of people came in angry. And you have to really go through this at length to find out what it was they were angry about, because he's more concerned about the violation of the decorum than he is about the substance of the concerns of the people there. In fact, I'm having trouble finding it at all, because what they did was what the city council in Oakland did was they simply adjourned without doing business. No contracts, no authorization to pay city bills, not even a shiny resolution. They denounced the civil public, the disruptions. And what you don't hear about, you hear that some members of the Occupy Oakland movement, here we go, What began last year as protests over wealth disparity in Occupy Oakland shifted to school closures and after the May 6th police killing of 18-year-old Alan Bluford, police violence, abuse, and repression. And you don't get any specifics on why they stopped, the meeting got invaded by the people. The people, the unruly mob, the that Alexander Hamilton was so concerned about. But this, in fact, is...
The mob has arrived.
No, you're the mobster there. The mobster has now arrived, so I'm going to have to stop denouncing the powers that be and denounce the power that just came through the door. But he's not really worthy of denunciation. I'll have to reserve my comments for someone...
He's just a member of a collective.
He's just a member of a defective, actually. We won't get into that at this time, though. Dennis is coming up next, though, with From the Cream to the Dregs, and he's... He's going to be doing what is happening tonight, Dennis?
Anything? More music.
Just
more fun.
Just music, and you didn't bring your ale with you. Where's your
ale?
You have ale. Yeah, fair. What that? And what say it ails you? You're going to. I better get out of here. The bad puns. So.
I haven't heard any bad puns yet.
Well, and you won't if you keep talking in that way. I'll be back on Sunday unless something good happens and I can find my way elsewhere. It's at 9:30 in the morning that the show resumes. I will be, by the way, tomorrow, I failed to announce this, meeting at 11:15 at the Java Junction, which is right near Highway 1 and Highway 9 in the shopping center, the... what is it?
There's a number of them, you know.
Gateway Shopping Center, actually it is. And we're going to be... kind of going into probably either to the St. Francis Soup Kitchen or the, I guess it is the St. Francis Soup Kitchen, to continue getting reports of people whose property has been taken or who have been harassed by folks in blue with guns and badges on the riverbanks and in the parks. So you can join us, 11:15, Java Junction. I'll be there with Becky Johnson. Even Dennis may show up. You never can tell. He may have some ale with him for what ails him.
No, I'll be in Mammoth Lakes.
He's going to be splashing around in Mammoth Lakes. Well, there you have it. In any case, maybe I'll see you there, or maybe you'll hear me on Sunday, and I'll hear you if you call in. If you want to catch me off air, 423-HUFF, 423-423-4833. You can also probably catch the last of the D-cell boondoggle as all the city council candidates justify their positions to the in the D-cell forum at the Loudoun Nelson Center. Last half hour is happening as I speak. So finally, ACLU did meet.
Say hi to Sal for me.
That's an attempted pun by Uncle Dennis. He'll perhaps have more of those, probably less, as his show continues.
More or less.
ACLU had a meeting on, I guess it was Wednesday, and they're still not denouncing the sweeps or the raids, as ACLUs and other cities have done, but they have formed a subcommittee with Steve Plaich on it to look into the issue. So everybody, keep your fingers crossed, and... we'll hope that they pull their heads out of their asses any year now and get to the issue at hand. Uncle Dennis, I think that's it for my show. If you've got something you want to put on, I encourage you to do so now before I begin another long speech, which may dismay you. You never can tell.
Well, I can certainly put something on, Robert.
Just don't put me on, big boy. Off air again, 423-4833, if you want to volunteer to help with anything that you've heard me talk about. Specifically, we're looking for people to help with documenting misconduct by the police and seizures of their property of the homeless folks. Again, we could use that kind of help. And Java Junction tomorrow at 11:15.